Oh, hey, it's me, Dave Hill, from Show Business. And this week on The Novelizers, the creator of Glee and Scream Queens, Ian Brennan. From Futurama and The Simpsons and Rick and Morty, Maurice LaMarche. Plus writer Sheck Baker. If you're listening to this on the road, for God's sake, pull over.
Don't want your popcorn, don't want your milk duds, don't want my shoes stuck in pools of sticky cola. Don't show me romance, don't show me fist fights, just show me words printed out under the book light. Yeah, baby, novelize the movie. Give me sentences, paragraphs, and nothing to see. Yeah, novelize the movie. Write a book and turn it into a podcast.
Welcome to The Novelizers. Steven, you know I don't usually say this, but this week is it's a pretty good show.
Not bad. Not bad at all. How you doing, Dave?
You know.
We never chit-chat. We just kind of get right into
we're
it.
I'm doing okay. I'm a little itchy, but otherwise good. It's cold. I'm really, I don't know what's going on with me. I'm wearing a hat right now. It's getting into wearing a hat 24/7 season for me.
Well, this episode will be heard in the future, so it'll be really in the depths of wearing a hat season when people listen to it.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
Cannot wait.
But you'll have to, because this week on The Novelizers, we have an amazing show. As usual, we are retelling The Dark Knight, audiobook style, but funny. Novelized by award-winning comedy writers.
Oh, yeah.
No exception this week. Who are our cast this week, Dave?
I'm glad you asked, Stephen Levinson. Ian Brennan is a writer and performer known for Monster on Netflix. He's also the creator of Glee and Scream Queens, which I was going to do that, but then I didn't. We also have Maurice LaMarche, who's voiced characters on animated shows like The Simpsons, Futurama, Rick and Morty, Pinky and the Brain, American Dad, Transformers, Looney Tunes, and basically the rest of them, too. I know. I was getting tired of naming them. It's like,
his IMDb profile is insane.
Man.
Because it's so long.
I gotta start voicing stuff. I mean, listen to this voice. You would think, but no. But maybe now, yes. Also, we have Sheck Baker, who's a comedy writer living in New York City. Hey, that's where I live.
You probably have run into him.
Probably. Round town. Yeah.
There you go. And before we get into it, what happens? Where are we in The Dark Knight? What's going to happen?
I'm glad you asked, Stephen. Gordon, Harvey, and Batman meet. Batman agrees to get Lao back from Hong Kong for questioning, even though it's really far away. Bruce gets upgraded equipment and leaves with the entire Russian ballet as his cover for traveling to Hong Kong. We've all been there. In the meantime, the Joker kills Gambol and forces the rest of his guards to fight for survival. A largely negative experience for all involved.
Why do they even bother?
Oh my gosh.
Well, Maurice LaMarche, novelize us.
Chapter 6, Wayne's World. Novelized by Sheck Baker. Narrated by Maurice LaMarche. From the shadows on the rooftop, Batman watched the DA pacing, stewing, really working over the cap of his Bic. A man in serious need of a fidget toy. Batman frowned. The Joker was one thing, but this guy? Batman didn't want to tangle with some high-strung weirdo. Not without Gordon around. No, here he'd remain in the blackness, hidden, blended with the night. The dark avatar of... You're a hard man to reach, Dent said. Batman looked around. Who was he talking to? There was no one else on the roof except Batman, artfully concealed in the shadows, invisible to the untrained eye. Dent was looking right at Batman, though. Making eye contact. Sizing him up, Batman thought. Maybe this guy Dent had also been to Secret Mountain Ninja School. I said, you're a hard man to reach, Batman. Okay, no doubting that one.
Hard to reach? You have a spotlight that shoots a picture of my face into the sky, and when you turn it on, I show up. What would be better? Like a red phone in my house that lights up and blinks when you call it?
Dent started to sputter and wag his finger at the spotlight like he had notes. Wait, Batman thought. That could be really sweet, a blinking phone like that.
Alfred could even pick up the red phone for him and beckon him with that adorable Cockney Master Wayne voice. A cool new red phone. He'd have to mention it to Fox. The rooftop door suddenly burst open and Gordon stalked through, looking frightful with a mop of stringy, unwashed hair, his tie loosened down to the third button, and trailing an odor of stale, lived-in flatulence. He glared first at Dent and then Batman while sucking a cigarette down past the filter. Batman didn't dig this energy. Batman needed these guys to chill.
"We need to talk about this spotlight, actually,"
said Gordon, grabbing the lever on the bat signal and shutting it off. "Right. It's a little arty," said Dent, gesturing disdainfully at the design on the light, a whimsical line drawing of Batman smiling, chin jutting out and sporting a pair of thumbs up. "It's classic," snarled Batman. "It's a Hirschfeld." Dent made the what-the-hell-is-that face. Gordon rolled his eyes, farting. "The caricaturist? You know, the guy who drew all the classic playbills?" Dent nearly exploded.
"Hirschfeld died before Batman Begins even came out,"
Batman gently explained. "It's an homage." Dent didn't bother hiding his disgust.
"What it is just a tad busy for an emergency communications device."
"What?" demanded Batman. "It's great. Looks like $1 million. Because it cost me $1 million.
"Okay, yeah," said Gordon. "It does look great from right here,"
he said, pointing at the roof.
"But we get it shining up in the clouds,"
he shook his head and sighed,
"it just kind of becomes this big, ugly mush."
"Oh, et tu, Gordon. So you use the spotlight that doesn't work right to call me up here to tell me about the spotlight that doesn't work right?" Gordon looked sheepish. "Was there anything else?" Dent didn't miss a beat.
"Oh, I'm way ahead of you. Laos halfway to Hong Kong."
Gordon crossed his arms, looking sour. Dent continued.
"If you'd have asked, I could have taken his passport. I could have taken his Dave and Buster's card. I could have made sure he never checked one more Dogman book out of the Gotham Library."
Gordon spat.
"They knew we were coming. All that was left in the vaults were like 500 baseball cards from the mid-90s. As soon as your office got involved..."
Now it was Dent's turn to spit.
"My office? You're sitting down here with scum like Officer O'Hara."
Gordon's eyes got big.
"Oh, that's right, Gordon, sure. To your face, O'Hara's always, faith and begorra this and bless me buttons that. But I had him dead to rights on 26 counts of human trafficking."
Gordon scowled while Dent prepared the coup de grace.
"And I'm not talking about the kind of human trafficking that the MAGA stands enjoy."
This was more like it, thought Batman. No more shit-talking the bat signal. Just a couple of civil servants choking each other to death over which of them had honked their foobar mob raid. Of course the bat signal fucking ruled. Even so, why not a belt and suspenders? Why not a bat signal and a blinking red bat phone? Yes, a shiny new bat phone. Batman liked the ring of that, he thought, and chuckled to himself. It occurred to Batman, however, quite gradually, that Dent and Gordon were no longer bickering and were both kind of staring right at him.
"Oh,
said Batman. Gordon slapped his forehead as Dent huffed.
"We need Lao back."
"Yeah, I know," said Batman. "I was totally listening."
Gordon and Dent shared an exasperated glance. Batman nodded grimly.
"Get Lao back. Right."
Dent winced and pinched the bridge of his nose.
"How will you get him back?"
He looked up toward Batman, but the Dark Knight had vanished. Dent looked slowly at Gordon. Then they heard a metallic bonking noise from the side of the roof, and they turned and watched as Batman gingerly legged over onto the fire escape and started to ease his way down, wheezing and grunting. Dent turned toward Gordon again, who raised an eyebrow and shot back a look, sighing,
"It does that."
The next day, Bruce Wayne paid a call on Lucius Fox in his office at Wayne Enterprises. Brightly lit, a bit on the small side, and surrounded by glass walls that peered into the executive boardroom, it was the kind of boss's office that let everyone know it did not belong to the actual boss. Fox eyed Wayne, hunched over two office chairs and sporting a truly Wayneful shit-eating grin, and reluctantly rose from his desk. His day was about to get 5 degrees more pain in the assy.
"Our Chinese friends left town before I could tell them the deal was off," said Fox.
"Friends?" Wayne said, puzzled. "Oh, right." He guffawed. "You're being sarcastic. Ha, 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 ha."
"Facetious," Fox corrected.
crossing over to a handsome bookshelf, with Wayne following a bit too closely, as usual.
I'm sure you always wanted to go to Hong Kong, said Wayne, winking. Wink, wink.
He winked. Fox grimaced and triggered a secret switch, causing a bookshelf panel to slide over and reveal a pair of Totally Boss fireman's poles.
What's wrong with a phone call? Fox asked, sensing his weekend was about to sprout wings and flutter away.
Wayne beamed.
I think Mr. Lau deserves a more personal touch.
Wayne gestured generously, with said gesture being the absolute limit of his generosity.
Care to join me on the pole this time?
Fox demurred and turned toward the staircase. Moments later, Fox emerged through the staircase door on the R&D level as Wayne whooped down the adjacent pole and landed with a clumsy thud.
Ouch!
He groped to his feet.
Hey, Fox,
he said, slapping Lucius on the back with an utterly unshared joviality.
You know it would be awesome? If, like, when we slid down the poles, we would get dressed in our costumes.
Costumes, Mr. Wayne? Asked Fox, nonplussed.
You know, said Wayne playfully, my bat suit.
But I have no costume, said Fox, unless you consider a grown man in a bow tie a costume.
Well, said Wayne, as he and Fox made their way over to some totally R&D-ass-looking cabinets, I've been thinking about that.
Oh?
Yeah, like, Wayne waved his hand grandly. Picture this. A yellow cape, a red tunic, a Lone Ranger mask.
Hearing this, Fox didn't so much raise his eyebrow as lock it and load it. Wayne continued,
and green short pants, like like a little boy.
Fox's expression betrayed none of the alarm he worked hard to contain, but a few beads of sweat emerged at his temples. Fox cleared his throat noisily and opened a big black case containing some gas tanks and a large respirator mask.
Here's all the shit you need for the high-altitude jump, he wheezed through gritted teeth. I must say, compared to your usual requests, jumping out of an airplane is pretty straightforward.
Wayne grinned again.
And what about getting back into the plane?
Fox coughed.
You mean without landing it, I'd guess.
Wayne pumped his fist.
Bruh!
Fox shrugged, as a man defeated 1,000 times shrugs.
Sure, I'll figure something out.
So fucking metal, agreed Wayne.
Fox turned and slumped over to Wayne R&D's version of a tool chest. He thumbed a button and one of the drawers shot open with a hiss, revealing a panoply of bat shin guards, bat gauntlets with pointy bat parts sticking out all over them, and other Batman hazurai of all shapes and sizes, cradled in a dark gray pillow of protective bat foam. Fox recited the bat specs of all the new bat gear while Wayne giggled and bounced up and down like a tyke who needed wee-wees.
Hardened Kevlar plates over titanium-dipped tri-weave fibers for flexibility. You'll be lighter, faster. Hey, put that down, Mr. Wayne.
It was, of course, too late, for Wayne had grabbed a bat gauntlet and began fiddling with the switches. And within moments, four razor-sharp bat-shaped knives had leapt from the hardened Kevlar plates and anchored themselves into the quite a bit less hardened facial bones of Lucius Fox, having first sliced offhandedly through several layers of flesh, sinew, cartilage, and countless vessels of various essential fluids. Blood welled in the slits between skin and titanium blade before trickling neatly down Fox's face. Keeping totally composed, Fox produced a large binder of colorful drawings and presented it to Wayne, who was wearing a strange look. A strange look, that is, for Wayne's face. Something not quite approaching compassion or even regret, but nonetheless akin to concern?
Perhaps you should read the instructions first, Mr. Wayne,
Fox said in a dignified moan.
A sequence of wordless pictograms, as you prefer.
Wayne took the binder, wiping off some of Fox's blood before returning his gaze to Fox.
Right, he paused. Lucius.
He began again, hesitating as if searching for just the right thing to say.
Lucius, listen.
He offered as tiny blood droplets collected together into small pools on the floor.
I got this amazing idea about a phone.
The details of how Lucius Fox absorbed Bruce Wayne's bat phone pitch are academic, for later that same day, Wayne met Alfred in some nondescript cavernous space that might have been another floor of Wayne Enterprises or part of the Batcave, or maybe the unfinished basement of stately Wayne Manor itself. It didn't matter to Chris Nolan, and it sure as fuck doesn't matter to us. Alfred produced a large roll of paper and began to roll it out on a convenient table as Wayne played with one of his new bat helmets.
I found one in Arizona, said Alfred. A very nice man who said he could have it made up and running in a week. And he takes ass, cash, or grace. However, he warned me that no one rides for free.
Found one what? Asked Wayne, tossing the helmet and, failing to catch it, nonchalantly watching it bounce noisily across the floor of wherever they were.
Now, Master Wayne, we're showing, not telling. Let the audience catch up a bit.
Wayne nodded. What about a flight crew?
You mean a flight crew for our new seaplane? Wayne blurted out.
Alfred tut-tutted. Wayne continued.
South Korean smugglers. They run flights into Pyongyang, below radar the whole way, and we never need to mention another goddamn thing about them for the rest of the movie.
Alfred nodded.
Did you think of an alibi? Asked Wayne.
At this, Alfred turned up the barest tint of a smile.
Oh, yes, he whispered,
and privately enjoying an unseen erection of the mind.
That evening, Dent practically dragged his date, Rachel Dawes, towards the ticket office of Gotham's Got Hams, Black Box Comedy Theater, in the city's trendy Butch Lick neighborhood.
Two tickets to see You Can't Improve Without Improv, said Dent,
plunking down a couple of sawbucks on the counter. After a rather shitty couple of days attorneying the district, Dent was really looking forward to some comedy that no one even wrote. Rachel was Dent's date.
Sorry, Mac.
The ticket taker was a stubby-looking fellow in a newsboy cap. He crumpled up the money and chucked it sideways.
No show tonight.
Dent's face fell as the ticket man jabbed a finger at a newspaper clipping taped up in the box office window. Dent squinted at the story.
Funny money. Billionaire invites entire musical improv comedy troupe onto private boat for a couple days, he read. City deprived of make-em-up song suffers explosion of mob violence?
Dent fumed, while a crowd of nearby rioters smashed windows and ran down the streets with TVs.
I guess the headline really says it all, said Rachel.
But tonight was sing-along night, Dent protested.
Rachel smiled ruefully.
Is that even plausible? Sing-along musical improv? How would that even work? She wondered.
The author did not know, nor did he care to know. What he cared was to transition to the next vignette. A sunny coastline, a handsome Wayne Enterprises tugboat, and half a dozen weary performers inventing lyrics on the spot for the delight of a single Cockney manservant in a wide-brimmed straw hat. As the show lapsed into its fifth hour, though, the frozen smiles of the troopers were beginning to crack.
All right, announced the pluckiest of them, a sweat-drenched pixie with a matted brown ponytail and a voice like a kazoo. Can we have a location? Tugboat, shouted Alfred.
Wayne lounged nearby in a deck chair, sunning himself.
Okay, shrugged the pixie. And an occupation? Cockney manservant. Ha ha, great,
he groaned. Just then, a battered Air Force surplus seaplane descended into the ocean several dozen yards off the port bow.
Have them take five, Alfred, said Wayne,
throwing a large duffel bag into the water and preparing to follow it overboard. The actors collapsed onto the deck. Alfred peered, unsmiling, at the plane. Wayne cocked his head at Alfred.
Something wrong, old chum?
Alfred gave a quizzical look.
I know we agreed not to mention the Korean smugglers again. But I have a keen ear for music, and it seems that your plane is singing, Master Wayne.
Oh, said Wayne.
Yes, sir. In fact, it sounds quite like a hybrid of Western genres like rap and R&B mixed with traditional Korean music,
offered Alfred. Wayne shimmied into his wetsuit.
And,
sir, it wouldn't surprise me one bit if that crew of so-called smugglers was engaging in a bit of complex, synchronized choreography, is all.
Wayne chuckled.
Those K-pop boys were all ex-military, Alfred. As long as one of them learned to fly a seaplane in the service, I don't give a rat's dripping shit what they sing all the way to Hong Kong.
Indeed, sir,
said Alfred. Wayne mounted the railing of the tugboat.
Will you be all right without me, Alfred?
Alfred looked back at the theater troupe sprawled, panting on the deck.
Master Wayne, I do believe we'll be quite all right here.
Wayne nodded and leapt off the railing while Alfred screamed,
Break's over!
Meanwhile, in Gamble's pool hall hideout, the break had yet to occur. You remember Gamble, right? The Gotham gangster who really didn't like the Joker? Well, anyway, Gamble himself was racking up a set of pocketballs alone when a couple of his bodyguards entered the room.
Somebody here for you, said the first guard. They say they killed the Joker. They want the reward.
Gamble looked up, spotting a trio of toughs in matching V-neck sweaters and flat caps in the front of the hall.
Yeah, they squealed. We killed the boss, all right.
Tight, said Gamble, rubbing his hands together. I don't have any more questions. Bring in the body. The toughs nodded and started to hoist up a body-shaped collection of black plastic bags into the pool room. But Gamble's bodyguard, whom we'll call Stuart, stepped in.
Whoa, 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 hold up, said Stuart. I'd better check this situation out first, right? Make sure it's cool before these strange guys start dragging weird and possible dead shit in here.
Why, said Gamble. He didn't need to take dead body advice from Stuart, of all people. Who was the throwaway first-act crime lord around here, anyway? He motioned for the three strange guys to put the body-shaped thing on the pool table, which for the moment would make it impossible to tell whether Gamble was any good at pool. The three strange guys complied, sniggering archly. Stuart watched, shrugging the old, I give up, shrug and backing away. Gamble pulled back one of the garbage bags, and sure enough, there was a Joker in there.
Voila! See, Stuart?
Said Gamble. You shouldn't be so suspicious of guys in matching golf outfits who say they killed the Joker. Gamble turned his back on the body and addressed the three guys. So let's see, that's 500 for a dead Joker. Gamble patted his pockets. I don't have any small bills. Do you have change for a million? Suddenly, to the surprise of everyone, the three guys did not have change. Also, the Joker wasn't dead. Before anybody knew what was happening, except the Joker had sat up and jammed a knife into Gamble's mouth. On top of that, those three guys beat up Gamble's bodyguards, even Stuart. The whole time they kept yelling, Biff! And Pow! And Crack! Gamble had to admit it was a pretty embarrassing moment. He wondered what the Joker was going to do next. What the Joker did next was to pull a fairly second date type move.
You want to know how I got these scars?
Gamble ventured a guess.
Did someone cut your mouth with knives?
The Joker didn't laugh. Like many self-described jokers, the guy was a tough fucking room. Instead, he plowed ahead with his scar story.
My father was a drinker and a fiend, and he didn't care about maintaining the architectural character of the neighborhood.
He licked his lips, but in a way that was really unsexy.
And when he was doing renovations on the house, he ignored the local zoning ordinances. He scoffed at the special requirements of the historic district. When the Landmarks Commission called him up, he asked them, why so serious?
Gamble couldn't believe what he was hearing. The Joker poked the blade more forcefully into the inside of Gamble's cheek and continued.
For instance, when he redid the lintels, he used non-standard materials and techniques without getting approval from the Public Design Commission. And when the PDC came calling, why so serious? And what's worse,
the Joker sneered,
he replaced the entire outer stone walls with siding. Plastic siding.
The Joker frothed. Gamble shook uncontrollably.
And when the Homeowners Association sued my father for non-compliance with 17 different regulations, you have any idea what he did then?
The Joker demanded.
Do you?
Gamble, terrified, shook his head. The Joker leaned in close, his mad clown makeup a tortured grimace.
He went down to the Department of City Planning, and he applied for a variance.
Gamble shuddered.
But that story doesn't explain anything.
At that moment, he fainted from shock. The Joker turned to Gamble's bodyguards, including poor Stuart.
Now, our organization is small, but we got a lot of potential for aggressive expansion. So, which of you fine gentlemen would like to join our team?
No one raised their hand, of course. They'd all died of boredom.
Man, that was incredible. But you know, the show's not over. I'll tell you that much, pal. Because every episode, we speak to someone who worked behind the scenes on, you know, on the movie.
True.
So let's talk to one of those people. What do you say?
I say let's do it. Let's hear that interview.
Hello, I'm Christine, and this is the interview portion of The Novelizers. And today I am so excited because we are talking to the one and only Harlan Carlin. And he was the locations manager on the film, The Dark Knight. Hi, Harlan. How are you?
Hi. I just want to correct you. I was the uncredited locations manager on The Dark Knight. I never received any credit because of some legal issues that maybe we're going to get into. This is the first time that I've actually come out and felt relatively safe talking about what I did and didn't do and what happened on the set of The Dark Knight. But yes, technically I was paid and then subsequently sued for my responsibilities as location manager on The Dark Knight, a film by Christopher Nolan.
Wow. Okay. So I have to sort of shift my head right now because I feel like we're actually going to get into some hot topics here and I'm totally in for it. And I'm really honored, honestly, that you've picked this platform as the first time to come out about this.
You're welcome. And we might as well just dive in.
Yeah, please go ahead. Start wherever you'd like.
No, I thought you were going to dive in.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It sounded like you had prepared almost a monologue and you were ready to share it with the world. And so I just wanted to give you the floor. But if you'd like for me to prompt you with a question that would probably lead to the monologue you were going to do anyway, then I'll do that. So here's your question. What was your experience working as the uncredited locations manager on the film The Dark Knight?
Well, it all went swimmingly. Getting the job working with American genius, who's British, Christopher Nolan, everything seemed great. And then he had the idea. It was during an early concept meeting. And he looked across the table to me and he said, I want to blow up a children's hospital. Can we blow up a children's hospital? And I said, well, certainly let me get on that. And I and my team of Paisley Dixon, Leif Houston, Miley O'Brien, and Clay Woodard, a spectacular team of assistants and associates, we set about scouring the city of Chicago for a location that American genius Christopher Nolan could blow up. And we found it. We found the West Lawn Children's Hospital that we would be able to use and have him blow it up with what I presumed would be CGI. I presumed he would be good do blowing it up in post.
Wow, that is a big presumption if it wasn't correct.
Well, and it wasn't, which I did not realize until we were rolling, that hospital was filled with live explosives.
And also, don't tell me
that hospital, Christine, that hospital was filled with live children.
Wow. Okay.
That hospital was filled with children.
My instinct is to say that this isn't true because I can't believe that this wouldn't have gotten out.
Because nobody wants to believe it's true. Okay? And there's been a whole covering up, a whitewashing of this horrific incident that is one of the most documented events in human history. There were 10 cameras rolling, Christine. 10 cameras.
Wow. So it's documented because we saw it.
Those are real. Yeah. And you clapped. Probably. You probably clapped.
I did. Even when I watched it last night in my living room.
You stood up and clapped. They all do. Those are real bodies, Christine. Those are real human bodies. I tried to stop. You can see me in one of the shots in the bus. I'm trying to run and tell Heath Ledger, who I don't think he knew. I don't think he knew what was going on. I don't think he knew. He'd sort of breeze in, put on his makeup, put on a dress.
On his own makeup?
Yeah, he put on his own makeup. He would listen to music and then he would just come in and sort of dance around. And then he never learned his lines. He would look at he only looked at the script right beforehand. He would sort of be like, okay. And then he would run out. I tried to stop him. You can see me. You can see me in two of the shots. You can see me in the helicopter shot. It catches me. And you can see it in the shot that pulls him. And I was trying.
Okay. So there's so many things to unpack here. First of all,
names. These are just some of the children whose lives have been snuffed out. Justice Ray, age 1. Jalen Fitzgerald, age 1. Andre Berg, Ashley Meyer.
Okay, I really hate to stop you during this, but if you literally have a list of thousands of children's names who all died during the shooting of this film, I'm going to have to stop you.
Look at the name. Oh, Ximena Harden, H9. Where's her Oscar? Where's her Oscar, Chris?
Okay, Harlan, let's just take a step back, because I want to make sure that whatever we're putting out here on this podcast is accurate.
Xavier, X-Z-A-V-I-E-R.
Usually it's one or the other.
That little boy never lived to get his name changed to a regular spelling of that.
Of either X or Z.
Who would name their kid Treasure? Grieving parents, that's who.
Yeah, well, they weren't grieving when they named him.
They came after me, Christine. They came after me because they knew. They saw one person. They knew I knew. They knew they did not get the permits. They were really not clear in the communication that they needed it to be an empty hospital.
Who rigged the building? Who rigged this building while it was an operating children's hospital?
Grips. The whole grip department was in on it.
Electric. How did they get in? How did the doctors let them in and watch them rig the building with explosives? Hospitals are occupied day and night.
Everybody said, ooh, it's genius, director. It's one of a kind. One in a million genius, Christopher Nolan. Oh, Chris, come on. I guess he, for verisimilitude. I guess he's got to roll in a lot of, he's very into realism.
But they see him rigging this building. They know, the doctors know, it's going to continue to be an operating children's hospital. No one's told them otherwise.
That was the agreement. You can't blow up a hospital.
Right, so they just believed it was going to be used, the exterior would be used, and then it would be CGI explosion.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct. Okay. And little did I know that the pre-light that night before, they weren't just rigging a few, you know, a Jenny truck and a place for, you know, for background holding to go. They had lined that whole sub basement with C4 explosives.
Harlan, why would
my heart? Okay, it's on my heart. It's on the heart of my wife Marlon and my son Judy and my daughter Carol. I've carried this with me for so long, the guilt, the anger, but mostly the guilt that I could let this happen, that this happened on my watch.
Why would Christopher Nolan want to explode a hospital that was filled with people? Why wouldn't he evacuate the hospital first?
Is high on his own supply.
Okay. And if everyone around him enabled this.
Chris is going to do it. And he's showing us. He shows us every time. His next movie, Tenet, he crashed a 747. Do you think, let me ask you a question, Christine. Do you think for a second he was allowed to do that? Do you think that was an empty 747?
Well, I would assume it was empty.
Oh, yeah. It was not empty. And I can talk. Location manager Van Hester and assistant Leslie Jaramillo.
Wait, I'm sorry. What was her last name?
Leslie Jaramillo. They're Jaramillo. In hiding. You're not, look up their names. You're never going to find it because they are in hiding.
I have to ask a few more questions about this hospital. So you had a very dynamic team working with you. And remind me, who was on the team again?
Moises Cortez. Catalina Mullins, Nellie Fowler, Kylo Booth.
Are you reading the kids' names off the list of kids who died, or are you reminding me the name of your team? You named a bunch of people that you really trusted that were on your team. So I would I wanted to know if your team, and if you wanted to remind me of those names, that would be wonderful. If you could just remind me of those names and tell me, are they aware? How do they feel about this?
They're all in witness protection, Christine.
And what are their names?
Sentry, Andy Hurley, Callum Zeringa.
No. Those aren't the same names. No, earlier you said names of your team, and they were all just first names, and these are names of the children.
No, I believe. My team, let me find my. It's a whole department. Silas Bullock, Shelby Villa, Adriel Fletcher, Gianna Welch, Quinn Church, Henry Houston, Frederick.
And how do they? How do they feel
about
this?
Hiding. We're all
Everyone's
scared.
Everyone's in hiding.
We're scared for our lives. Because we know how powerful this American psychopath, Christopher Nolan, is.
Okay, so here's the question.
He's going to come after me. I wouldn't be surprised if this is the last time that Judy and Carol see their dear dad.
Your son, Judy, and your daughter, Carol?
Yes, named after Judy Davis. Grow up. Grow up. Legendary Cubs catcher. It was actually named Jody Davis.
What's your wife's name again?
We spelled it Marlon.
Marlon Harlan. Oh, that's must have been a really nice wedding invite. I do have a question for you. So you're all in hiding. Did you said you don't think Heath knew about this? And you know he's pushing the detonator. Obviously that's a fake detonator. That's just a prop.
I almost called cut for Chris because I said he's pushing it. The explosions will go off. CJ, we've got the shot, and then the horror of seeing it happen in slow motion and then watching it in the movie theater. It literally happens in slow motion.
What about the parents of these kids? Did they speak out?
Silenced. They have tried.
Okay.
I remember the parents of Harmony Reynolds.
Oh yeah. What were they like?
Well, that's Gianni and Jalen, or Harmony's mother, and it's Harmony with an I, and I just wish that Harmony could have grown up to reach the age where she said, "God damn it, this name's crazy."
Harlan, I have to tell you, there have to be investigators and lawyers who would absolutely eat this up. This has got.
No one will touch it. It's a third rail. You don't know. Hollywood's in on it.
A documentary filmmaker who wants to expose the truth.
If they're out there, you know, this is probably going to be my last will and testament, but I'm just saying dig deep because they and watch your back. Okay. Because I live in mortal terror every day that coming out and speaking my truth and speaking the truth that 1,000 children died that day so he could get a great shot. Well, listen to me, psycho Chris Nolan, director, lunatic, genius in a not good the way that Pol Pot was a genius.
Oh, yeah.
Just, he's going to burn in hell and it's not quick enough. And I hope when he's there, he's thinking about Isaac Turner.
Have you had a single conversation with him since this happened? What have you tried to communicate to him? What happened to you after this building was blown up?
I mean, a lot of it is a blur, but what I did the rest of that day, I guess I looked around and everybody was clapping. I saw all this clapping, and I didn't quite know what happened. It was like a waking dream that I was never gonna awaken from. And I looked around. And I turned to my team, Zora, Rowan, Rose, Camden, Frankie, Bryson, Hayden, Baylor. And I said, is this happening? And I remember Addison Hill, my great number two, she leaned over and she picked up. I thought it must be a prop. And it was a little tiny human foot. And that's when I knew my life changed. I left the set that day. I tried to call my union, the Location Managers of America, LMA, and they did not pick up the phone. Oh, and then I tried to call the DGA. They did not pick up the phone. Then
did
I tried
to try calling the police.
I tried to call the police. They didn't pick up the phone. I tried to call 911. They didn't pick up the phone. That's how deep this goes, Christine. Fear for my life. It's so deep.
What made you decide to come out and expose this today with us?
I just think, I think it's the insomnia. I can't really reliably sleep. The only way I can get to sleep is counting names.
Counting names or saying names?
I say them while I count them.
Count them.
Because I've memorized them. There's one, Felicity Conley. Two, Jonas Barrera. Three, Willa Lugo. Four, Maximiliano Collins.
I don't know how you're living with this, Harlan. This is too much for a person to live with.
It is.
This needs to come out.
It does. It does. And hopefully, you know, this is such an enormous platform.
I do have one question for you. So this is such a massive cover up on a scale that I've never, ever heard of in my entire life. And I'm just curious, is it possible that you thought there were humans in the hospital and it actually was an old candy store that was slated for demolition, which is what the story is about the blowing up of that building?
I see they've gotten to you.
Oh, no, they haven't gotten to me. I'm not compromised. I just Googled the hospital blow up. And so I see what other people see.
Do you think Google isn't in on it? Do you think they're not going to wipe it? God damn it.
I'm not doubting you. I'm just raising a counter argument.
When you doubt me, you're doubting Zaid Jiang, Raina Olson, Soren
Rain Green, Wilson?
Sellers. Raina Olson, not Rain Wilson. Although I wouldn't, if he was in that building, let's say he had a little baby who had a little hole in its heart and it needed to go on down to the West Chicago Children's Hospital. You bet your hiney that he'd be on this list. And he'd probably have it in, his name's Rain. What would his daughter's name be? Pavement. And she'd be on this list right next to Marvin Santiago.
God, I'm so glad she's not.
Aziel Christian. Juan Sampson. Khaleesi Chambers. Khaleesi. That's Harlan. that's a name that didn't get famous
until much
after. And just shows how prescient you can sometimes be as a parent.
Can I ask you, so you're obviously struggling a lot. You don't really sleep. This must be all you're thinking about. Are you working? Have you continued a career? What do you do with your days?
I have moved into the floral industry.
I see that beautiful backdrop behind you.
Yeah, this is just a large format wallpaper. It's not a flower itself.
But selected by someone who loves flowers, clearly.
Yeah. And I try to always think that when I am doing an arrangement, often ironically for funerals, then in a way I'm giving a funeral for those little beautiful babies at that children's hospital who didn't get one. Children like Dawson Parker, Colt Dudley, Blaze Gardner. Ugh. Blaze. What kind of fucking name is that?
I don't know. That's a very strange thing to name a child. That's an American
Gladiator name. What kind of fucking psychopath? Madden Blankenship.
Harlan, I have to ask you something. Yeah. How can I help you? All I do is interview people who worked on films for this podcast. It's literally all I do. I have time. I can help. How can I help you?
I think what you can help, and you already are doing it, is just raise awareness.
Exposure.
About onset explosions. Because it is an epidemic. As a Hollywood location manager, I am telling you, 99% of explosions that you see on screen, they are not permitted. Those buildings are full of people who live there, who work there, and they are being silenced.
Why would anyone want to do that? Why wouldn't they empty the building?
The money, Christine, it's cheaper.
It's cheaper because then you don't have to move bodies out of those buildings.
And you don't have to ask permission. You know that old adage? It's easier to beg forgiveness than ask permission.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's even easier? It's easier to blow people up than to get a permit.
And never ask forgiveness or permission.
No. And I just think that the more we can get the word out, and you can go to my website, it's xexplosions. But it's EX.
Like you're an X.
Like I'm an X. I mean X explosions.
Yeah.
So it's EX underscore EX colon plosions dot CA dot gov.
It's a government website?
It is.
How did you do that?
It suggested it. Just Squarespace suggested it. But it's backslash 194-8386.
Okay, I'm going to tell you, Harlan, right off the bat, like this website is not good because it's not easy for people to remember. If everyone has to write it down every time you tell them.
Explosions, but I'm at X. I'm used, so it's X.
That part isn't even as complicated as all of the stuff that comes after it. .gov and then numbers after the gov.
Well, okay.
That's a hard to remember for people.
But it's 12987. So yeah, 1 + 2 = 3. Go back to the first one, add 1, you get 4. 4, go back to the 1, add 4 again, and it's 9. Like it's all ones. It's all you add ones and multiply.
So
take away, it's 1 + 2 = 3.
As much as I appreciate you walking me through the logic of you creating this website on Squarespace, I have to tell you, Harlan, it's not doing you any favors. It's not. These numbers aren't doing you favors. You need something simple.
Do a favor to?
Please tell me.
Crosby Sierra, Ryder Ferguson, Kamari Woods, Simone Gonzalez, Robert Morse, Amira LeBlanc, Josiah Chandler. That's an insane.
Oh, Harlan, I can't. I just can't have you name any more names. It's too hard on you. And frankly, it's
Thatcher Poo.
That
can't be a real name.
P-O-O?
No, maybe it's Pew. Maybe it's Pew.
Harlan, listen, I think you need to take a break. I think you need to go get yourself a nice cup of tea. Oh, you have one. That's lovely. And maybe just take a nap, take a little rest here, because I know this was very exhausting for you. And I have to tell you, I'm so grateful for you coming forward with the truth here, because people need to know. And I will use this platform, the podcast, the Novelizers. This is the first interview I'm doing for this entire Dark Knight season. We've probably got 25 interviews. So wow. I can promise you that I'm going to reference this in at least a couple of those interviews. I will reference it.
It would not surprise me if they all said, what? Who's Harlan Carlin? What?
Okay, I'm really glad I know that, because now I can be ready for it.
Vivian Wilcox, Emmeline Hensley, my great team, Dennis Rosales, Angela Valentine.
Who was your number one again?
My number one was Magnolia Ali. Oh,
wow, you must have had multiple number ones. Harlan, I just want to thank you. I want to thank you so much. I'm so grateful.
Yeah, honestly, I really feel like I've gotten something off of my shoulders.
And what I'm going to promise you, my promise,
weight off of my chest and my shoulders.
I'm going to promise you that I will reference this at least one or two more times this season. On this podcast.
It's a multiplier, you know.
Yeah. Every time it's exponential, you know?
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you hearing.
I'm so sorry to have doubted you if that's what it felt like. I just had to ask the question, but now I'm Team Harlan.
Thanks, Christine.
Well, listen, you know, don't be a stranger. And if I never hear from you again, I'll assume that you continued to stay in hiding, not that you were, you know,
who knows? You'll never
strategically
know.
Removed from the earth.
You'll never know. I'll never know. I mean, I will know. I would know. I'll know if I'm allowed to live. If I won't, if I'm killed, I won't know.
Well, you won't know it after you're killed, but you might know it right before you're killed.
Yes, sure. But does the computer, what does the computer feel like when it gets turned off? Doesn't. If it sees somebody walk, if the computer sees somebody walking towards it with a gun, that.
Yeah. What would it do?
I think the computer would maybe pop a disk out, pop a floppy disk out the front.
This is probably all it could do. And lucky if that computer had a floppy disk, because computers don't have those anymore. We're talking the laptop I'm on right now. We don't have those. What would that computer even do?
I think it would just cry. I think it would cry little bits of it. Would all the moisture it could try to generate would maybe seep out of the keyboard.
This is a really beautiful and kind of amazing metaphor. I definitely don't understand it, but I do appreciate it, and I think you do, and that's what matters. Listen, Harlan, I'm gonna leave you to have your feeling. Thank you so much for spending time with us today, and again, my promise to you is I will reference this at least one or two more times in the interviews I conduct this season. Bye, Harlan.
Man, that was the stuff.
That was great. And now that show really is over. So
it really, oh man.
Yeah.
I was just getting started.
Oh, I know. But you'll have to wait for next week.
Yeah.
Thank you to this week's guests. Ian Brennan, Maurice LaMarche, Shaq Baker. Hi, Shaq.
And also, thanks to you, listener person, for listening. Because if you don't listen, what's the sound of a podcast that no one listens to? I mean, I guess that's probably the sound of most podcasts, actually.
Yeah.
Saying it out loud. But not this one.
Not anyone on Cincinnati Public Radio.
Yeah, you kidding me?
They are hot.
H-O-T. Hotter than Skyline Chili. Oh, does that ruin the whole public broadcasting?
It. No, that's a good
okay.
Good Cincinnati
to throw
reference.
Some local, you know, hotter than a Bootsy Collins bass line.
There you go.
Hotter than an Afghan Whigs album.
Are they Ohio? Huh?
Yeah, Cincinnati. Come on.
Oh, how did I not know that?
Hotter than an Ohio Players album cover.
There you go.
The Novelizers is hosted by me, Dave Hill, with Stephen Levinson. And produced by Stephen, Dennis DiClaudio, Cole Emhoff, Graham Douglas, Kevin Carter, Christine Bolin, Rob Kuttner, and Marla Radner. And distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. Editing and mixing by Graham Douglas. Music by Cole Emhoff. Theme song by Andrew Lynn, recorded by Knotts. Additional editing by Andrew Lynn and Sunita Haberlein. Special thanks to Brad Combs and Parabolic Studio in Manhattan. Follow the Novelizers on Instagram and support us on Patreon. The Novelizers is written and recorded without the use of AI. The Novelizers is an unauthorized work of parody. Copyright 2025, Novelizers, LLC.
En Cox, estamos un paso adelante. Como el muchacho que ya sabe la orden de tu cafecito incluso antes de pedirlo.
Hey, José, café con leche sin lactosa, un toque de vainilla templadito sin azúcar.
En Cox también nos adelantamos a lo que necesitas. Por eso el precio de tu plan no subirá por 3 años. Y nuestra seguridad avanzada protegerá tu red de amenazas antes de que pasen. Cox, un paso adelante. José, llamada de tu jefe en 3, 2, 1. Al menos 500 megabits por segundo de velocidad y Cox Unlimited Mobile. Impuestos y cargos no incluidos en garantía de precio. Velocidad de datos móviles reducida tras usar 20 gigas al mes.